Welcome to Conversations in World History. So this is the third in my series of episodes about pre-Columbian Mesoamerican civilizations in my conversations with Professor John Schwaller and Professor Matthew Restall. Dr. Schwaller is a scholar of early colonial America, of Nahuatl and Nahuatl language and people, author of 5 books, more coming out, 50 articles. He's the editor of scholarly journals and just a fascinating person to speak with. Matthew Restall, professor of colonial Latin American history of Penn State University, who I spoke with in one of my first episodes of the podcast. He specializes in Yucatan and Mexico, Maya history. He's written fantastic books like 7 Myths of Spanish Conquest and Montezuma and Cortez, books about their encounter, and he has a new one coming out about Diego de Landa. So I highly recommend listening to the earlier episodes, even if you think that you don't have an interest in other civilizations besides the Mexica or the Aztecs, because there are so many insights that come out in those earlier conversations about history and the way we talk about non-European history and write about them and how history is produced. But this conversation about the Mexica is fascinating as well. Hope you enjoy.
We move on to the Aztecs, who did not call themselves the Aztecs. This is a very modern invention, as Matthew again can elaborate extemporaneously and extensively on. They call themselves the Mexica. And I really wish that we would begin to call them by their proper name. I am so frustrated at this point, being a retired teacher, of being forced by publishers to call them Aztecs, because I would like to put Mexica in the title of my book, in the titles of my articles, but the publishers say, well, you know, when people are looking for the Aztecs, it's just not going to come up in a Google search.
Mm-hmm.
And so we continue to throw the name Aztec into the title of books and into the title of chapters and into the title of articles so that it will pop up to individuals who are curious about those people in their Google searches. But this is so frustrating to me. I wish that textbooks would begin to call people by their proper names. And these folks knew exactly who they were. They called themselves the Mexica. Let's stop, please.
Right.
Well, and it starts with textbooks like this, right?
Because exactly.
David's students are the future, audience for people who are Googling to look for books on the Aztecs.
Right.
Right. Exactly. And if they've been taught in high school that these are the Mexica that used to be called Aztecs.
Yes. And then there is one very brief reference that who were then called the Mexica. But of course, the subtitle of this section is the Aztec Empire. And now this is a much longer section, as we would expect, about the Aztecs. And it covers a great deal more. It refers to the Triple Alliance. It refers to their military conquest and how they treated neighboring societies that joined up with them and paid tribute or did not. It talks about the social class of Aztec society divided into 3 classes. It describes as nobles, commoners, and slaves. It goes into depth and gives a real sense of the richness of Tenochtitlan. I would imagine, at least from my point of view, it does a nice job in this section, again, of building up that this was an advanced, rich civilization. Going back a little bit to what Matthew was talking about before, then digs into religion and has a huge section about how religion rules Aztec life. And I wish this were a video podcast so people could see not only the textbook, but John's physical reactions to things that he's got a very expressive sense whenever he agrees or disagrees with someone.
It goes into the sacrifice. It goes into problems of the Aztec Empire, Montezuma's reign. It has some nice spread with images, and then closes out, as we're getting into, with the upcoming arrival of the Spanish, and then goes back to this legend of Quetzalcoatl, and this kind of bookends what they were talking about before. All right, so let's start off with, and we'll start off being nice. What does this get right? What does it do the best job on? John, why don't you start us off with that, and then Matt?
Well, I thought the part of Tenochtitlan as a planned city was actually quite nice. I appreciated that they attempted to give you a walk through the city. I mean, this was a huge city, potentially one of the largest cities in the world at the time. I think they dropped the ball a little bit because it was a twin city. They talk about Tlatelolco, the other half of the city, but you know, politically they were two independent cities that became joined later in history. In that sense, I think it was quite nice. And even the section on the overall structure of Mexica society was not that bad. I would have had different word choices in some places, but I think for a textbook at this level, it was fine. As Matthews pointed out, where they're grounded in archaeology and in hard evidence, the authors are much better. Yes, we know the approximate scope geographically of the Triple Alliance that was headed up by the Mexica. We know the population, we know the provinces. This is all fairly well explained. Where they get off the rails completely is in the discussion of religion.
So we'll come back to that. Matt, do you agree?
I agree with Fritz. It's like it's basically fine. They're not the train is, to try and keep with my silly metaphors, the train is more or less on the tracks here. And of course we could kind of disagree with particular things. There's no way Tenochtitlan had a population of between 200,000 and 400,000. That's totally ludicrous. You know, the size of the island could not support that unless you had multi-story buildings, which you didn't. And actually, this is where the Spaniards kind of, there was a rare example of where Spanish observers, I think, were right, and that has kind of upheld this. It was about 60,000. The problem is 60,000 doesn't seem like a big city to us, right? Mm. Because we're so used to cities having, you know, 10, 20 million people. But when, so the important thing is to understand that Tenochtitlan was just sort of the center point of a kind of an extended sort of semi-urban settlement that encompassed large areas of the southern part of the lake. So the second city in the empire was Texcoco, and is just visible across the lake from Tenochtitlan. They can see each other. They're easily accessible back and forth by canoe. And Texcoco would have been about the same size as Tenochtitlan. So the way to present this is to say, you know, these two cities have about 60, 70, 80,000 people each. And then there's that many people again in other cities around the southern basin, and that results in a metropolis that is larger than any capital in anywhere in Europe, right? So that's the way to do it, is to do it as a kind of a comparison, because it's just sort of this reaching. It's like, well, we want to make sure we convey how really big it was, so we'll just kind of make up huge numbers. and it has a way of kind of undermining any of the other things you're saying about how this was an important civilization, which is important because, you know, as you know, we're about to get to a part about religion, which takes the rug out from under that completely and turns them into barbarians, right?
Yeah. And so I guess a comparison would be if you to look at New York City and you were to add, let's say, Newark and that part of New Jersey into the larger New York City metropolitan area, is
Yeah, and the good recent work has been to say to take New York City, right, and look at how take Manhattan and how big it is and its population, and then understand how multi-story buildings are what make the Manhattan population so great. If you reduce all the buildings in Manhattan to a single story, one floor, what would the population of Manhattan, what could it possibly be? And of course, then it collapses down to something on the same kinds of level as Tenochtitlan, right? That kind of level of population density. But anyway, I mean, these are relatively small things. These are kind of fun things to talk about that don't get one kind of worked up and apoplectic. But if you scroll down, David,
Hold on, hold on 1 second, Matthew. But before we do that, let me just throw out there, it does give the sense of these vibrant markets, right? Which a vibrant sense of the society. Before we get into things that we think it might get wrong, is there anything you think that's just really left out? That's if you were to add in 1 to 2 more paragraphs about Mexica pre-Columbian society, what would you add in that's just not there at all?
I don't see much about art and philosophy and literature, unless it's on a different page that you're not showing me. But
No.
I mean, there was a well-developed culture of music, song, dance, literature of all kinds. I mean, essentially, we just have to kind of think of, okay, what corresponds a fully developed culture? What do we think of as elements of culture in our society, or even perhaps more realistically in European societies in the 15th and 16th century, right? And kind of come up with that kind of checklist of things that maybe students might be aware of when they think of Europe or even East Asia in the 15th and 16th century, markets, festivals, or kind of regular religious festivals. What's happening at those festivals is there's theater and dance and music and a lot of stories about the way the world is are being presented to people through poetry and music and theater and so on, right? That this is also something that we take for granted. Well, let's take that framework and then apply it to the Aztecs, or rather to the Mexica, and see if we're going to find those elements. And of course, we do, despite the problems of evidence, right? Despite the fact that we don't have, piles of documents written by them in the 15th century that have survived and so on.
Right.
Despite that, it's still really clear that there was all of this, all of these elements and aspects of a fully developed culture, in which violence and warfare, are marginal, right? Of course, they're in there, just as if you go to Europe or East Asia and start looking at these songs and theater and so on, you're going to find that there's elements of that. But also, what else are you going to find? A lot of stuff to do with human relationships, love and sex and romance and relationships between parents and children and all of that kind of stuff is right there in Aztec culture. And I would like to see more of that in here, right? So that students can kind of connect and see, hey, they were just like us. If we go back in time to Tenochtitlan in the year 1500, especially high school students, they're going to find their peers are going to be there, experiencing the same kinds of sort of, challenges and dealing with each other and dealing with parents and teachers and trying to kind of find their own place in the world. It's a society and a city in which they would be able to kind of relate, right? They're not going to get in there and be like, oh my God, this is so completely alien, and any minute now I'm going to be dragged up a pyramid and have my heart ripped out while I'm still alive. That's not what they're going to find, but that's might what might be what they expect from reading this textbook.
Yeah.
I think Matthew's correct, certainly in terms of the creative arts, of poetry, of literature in general. It was a very, very, very rich society, but also craftsmanship. I mean, the illustrations themselves should be partially responsible for that. These were individuals who had exquisite craftsmanship, who made beautiful articles out of precious stones, out of precious metals, and recognized the value of them and also honored and respected the individuals, the craftsmen who made these pieces, and also the poets and troubadours, if you will, who were the authors of the great poetry that they had. We have poems attributed to individuals in the collections that were copied down in the 16th century. So yeah, certainly Matthew is correct. We have no idea of this richer, deeper side of the civilization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that seems to be a huge absence. And I love that idea of this kind of checklist that you were talking about, Matthew. I have a acronym that I use actually when we're, and it is in some senses problematic. It is GREAT, which is what we look at. And we look at government, religion, economy, arts and architecture, and technology, right? So that's how right. I kind of do that checklist with my students of what makes these societies great. And then we can look at how those play out in all the societies. And as you guys point out, the A is really missing here, the arts and architecture and anything of that sort. So now let's dig into, is there anything in this section? And I feel like this is, by now people probably know the answer. Is there anything in this section that you guys have a problem with, despite the difficulties of putting together a textbook that gets your blood pressure up a little bit?
Oh, yes. John, oh, yes. I scribbled all over the page of Religion Rules Aztec Life. I was screaming through the whole thing. It's just awful. What I think is mostly frustrating is that this is what we're learning here is pretty much the same thing that I learned 50 years ago, or I don't want to tell exactly how old I am, perhaps even 60 years ago when I first started studying the Aztecs as a small child. And it's just horrible. I think to use a simple word, it's not at all clear that the authors here have seen any of the recent scholarship, in spite of the fact that there was a major article in the American Historical Review that all historians, of course, are supposed to be reading. How long ago did Cami write that article, Matt? It must be 25 years ago.
Yeah, it came out when she was working on that, when I was writing Seven Myths, because we were working in parallel and in communication with each other. So,
are you talking about Camilla Townsend?
Camilla Townsend.
Yeah, yes. that was 20 years ago now.
Who was the first person to debunk the whole Quetzalcoatl myth. Matthew has done his part with Seven Myths. It's just, and we've had a couple of other individuals who've written fine pieces since then, that this is really quite horrible that we're continuing the Quetzalcoatl myth of somehow this redeemer coming from abroad, being pale-skinned man with a beard. That is completely something that was added by the Spaniards to whatever small legends there might have been about Quetzalcoatl.
I mean, that line is so ludicrous. One would hope horrible. That high school students would
spot
that.
Can you read the line?
The Aztec, and it's very prominent because it's the end of the first paragraph on religion. The Aztecs pictured Quetzalcoatl not only as a feathered serpent, but also as a pale-skinned man with a beard. I mean, the thing is even that, you know, the historic Jesus Christ was not a pale-skinned man with a beard, right? He was dark-skinned. I mean, the white man with a beard is Fritz, you would know when that dates to, but it dates to the late medieval period. I'm not a specialist.
You mean that Christ is depicted as a white skin, pale skin?
The whitening of Christ, and then eventually he becomes blonde haired.
Yeah. It's very late that he becomes even European at all.
Yeah, it's a later thing. So, this is problematic on two levels, right? It's problematic in terms of just thinking about the history of Christianity, but then not not making it clear to students that that's actually what we're talking about here. We are not talking about, you know, the Aztecs and Quetzalcoatl. This is something that's completely been invented and inserted. But they need to understand why it's been invented and inserted and who did it and what the purpose was. And that's the most problematic part. It's not just that, oh, there's a misunderstanding of evidence and there's something else has crept in. It's like, why? Because as I said earlier, it's about an imperial agenda. It's about, you know, attempting to destroy Aztec culture and society in order to justify replacing it with something else. It's to justify imperial expansion. And I don't know, I don't know where even to go with that. But David, when you're talking about this in the classroom, there's other parallels to invasions that you surely talk about, whether they're historical, whether there's something that's going on right now, right? Mm-hmm. That people would be able to understand. It's like, oh yeah, sure. One country invades another and then systematically engages in a kind of PR campaign to denigrate their culture in order to attempt to completely destroy it. And that PR campaign is still what everybody believes 500 years later. That's an astonishing story to me.
That is the horrible part of it, right?
Yeah.
And so I just want to jump in because it's so interesting, this idea of how history is produced, right? So the textbook is what I would generally call a tertiary source, right? As you guys were pointing out before, they're not going back and looking at reading through all the primary sources. They're really depending on the work of secondary sources, other scholars like yourselves, but it's clear they haven't read your work or Camilla Townsend, who I'll come back to at the end of the podcast. So they're maybe not... I think what's frustrating you guys, if I'm to try to jump in and speak for you for a minute, even though you do it yourselves, is they're not necessarily staying up to date on the recent scholarship, and they're relying on kind of old tropes about the history. And then things are just getting recycled and regurgitated generation after generation. When you guys have spent your whole entire life, academic life, working against this. A couple other things that jumped out at me that I wanted to ask you guys about, again, is the description of the societies themselves as fierce and ambitious. Yes. And it also talks about two other things I wanted to ask you about. One is that when other neighboring societies didn't join up to them, they destroyed rebellious village centers. I wanted to ask you guys if that's true, if you agreed with that. And it also says that they practice human sacrifice on a massive scale. And it describes, so you guys obviously have an issue with the term human sacrifice itself, but it talks about thousands of prisoners a year. So John, why don't you start off with that? I either those two, did you have any issues or did with them?
Well, certainly what we do know is that through the use of ambassadors and merchants, and I appreciated the fact that at one point they did point out that merchants did work as spies, or we could call them diplomats in this particular context, entered into negotiations and discussions with adjoining polities. In many instances, the polities joined into the Triple Alliance and paid their taxes into the Triple Alliance as part of being a member in a larger economic and military organization. Let's think about that. That is, in many ways, the European Economic Community. The difference here is that if a group decided not to join in, yes, there was always the threat of violence because the Triple Alliance had become quite powerful. The number of sacrificial victims, which I think was your other question, David, is really tough to know. We have body counts that the friars and the conquistadors gave us, we know that these are greatly, greatly exaggerated. But we do have some physical evidence. We know how many skulls there were in the skull rack of Tenochtitlan, which was a major ceremonial center. So it's difficult to come to any exact numbers, probably far fewer than what is generally reported. So that I would have to leave the numbers at that. Matt?
Yeah, I agree. I think the numbers are massively exaggerated. I mean, that's the first thing to point out, that you can't accept those numbers. And it's and there's very clear evidence of when and where those numbers are being being made up and kind of accepted. You know, in the late 16th century, people are sitting around, walking around in Mexico City saying, did you know 100 years ago, they used to like sacrifice thousands and tens of thousands of people? No way, right? That's kind of the level of what we're talking about. And the skull rack in Tenochtitlan, you know, we are a long way from really having a good kind of balanced objective understanding of where all those skulls come from. There's no evidence that all of those people who were sacrificed. They could just easily have been people who had died in battle or people who died of natural causes. There were way more skulls in the catacombs of Paris underneath that city, but no one talks about them as being, you know, sacrificial victims, right? So it goes back to this kind of uneven way of looking at things. But you talked about, I want to kind of come back to a couple of things that you both said, as I know we're kind of coming towards the end of our time here. Anyone listening to us might imagine, oh, these guys are all about just rehabilitating the Aztecs and pushing the pendulum all the other way to make them out to be these, like, you know, sort of peace loving ultimate example of a civilization. I think the important thing to emphasize here is that the Aztecs, or whatever we should be calling them, were an empire. Mm-hmm. And that what the textbook is missing out on here is an opportunity to talk about empire, that people don't do bad things because they are of one particular race or one nationality or have a particular religion, right? That in the 21st century is not an acceptable way of categorizing people. And I think rightly so. People do bad things because of particular cultural developments to do with warfare and violence and empire. This is about empire. And the reason why it's so important to emphasize how the Aztecs are an empire and that the violence that they commit is to do with empires because another empire is about to show up on their doorstep. And it allows students to then kind of see that this isn't about bad Aztecs and good Spaniards, or bad Aztecs, bad Spaniards, and good, you know, English-speaking Protestants, or whoever you want to make as the kind of the good people, or, you know, like the pilgrims. Oh, the pilgrims, they're so peaceful. But look south, it's all blood and mayhem because it's Catholic Spaniards and terrible Aztecs, right? You got to see it in terms of empire so that they understand that, you know, there's reasons why people do bad things. And if you're looking at a world history textbook, at some point, you're then going to have to understand something like the Holocaust. How does the Holocaust happen? And if you are trying to tell students, it's like, you know, Germans are not bad people. So that doesn't explain the Holocaust. So how can you explain it? You have to kind of set that up beforehand. And I think, you know, empire and conquest and so on, it works really well as a kind of perhaps oversimplified, but nonetheless less problematic kind of framework. So were the Aztecs violent? Yes. Did they conquer their neighbors? Did they, you know, were there massacres and so on? Yeah, there were, because they were an empire.
But it's not in their blood, I think, is what you're saying. It's part of the human experience. And it also, I think, doing that both raises the Aztecs up, but also to some degree, because showing that they had the same inclinations, the same richness, but also problems as any other civilization, but also at the same time, to some degree, takes Europeans off a pedestal, right? These were the only Europeans ever created empire, only ever colonized other groups. And, you know, to some extent, we need to also take away that notion of that superiority. Right. I I definitely want to be respectful of your guys' time. We've been going on for quite, this has been absolutely fascinating. I can't wait to use this with my students and and elsewhere. To close off, I wanted to ask you guys, now, Matt, last time we talked, you recommended Camilla Townsend, who we've already mentioned, her book, The Fifth Son. I read it. I absolutely loved it. I wrote her and talked to her about it. So I want to throw out that I want to give that same recommendation, The Fifth Son, for someone who's really interested in learning more about Aztec history and culture. Can each of you recommend another book for the lay reader if you have of Aztec civilization, or is that really the book that you would point people to?
That's hard.
There are some brand new books that are coming out immediately, which is part of the problem. And I'm sure Matthew has the same problem that I do, is that I get sent books that are in production that I'm an outside reader for. And there are a couple that I'm very excited, but they aren't out yet. And at this point, I can't give the names, unfortunately. I will say that to my students at the university level, I recommend Matt's book on Seven Myths. It's still a great book and an absolute point of departure. Other than Cammie's book, Camilla Townsend's book, The Fifth Son, we don't have the kind of summary of the Mexica that I would be comfortable assigning to people. This is one of the things that's pretty far back on my to-do list. I'm trying to talk others into doing it. But I think with all of the great research that's gone on the 25 or 30 years, well, actually 74, do the math, 50 years since Matt's dissertation advisor opened up the whole world of Nahuatl language documentation, we really need somebody to sit down and write a good synthesis of Mexica history based on primary sources, which is what Cammie does, but in a more episodic way, focusing on the documents.
Are you aware, David, of a site called shepherd.com?
No.
Like herd sheep, S-H-E-P-H-E-R-D. It has people like me, writers, historians, people like me and Fritz on there, giving lists, like five, I think I have one that's like five best books on the Aztecs, that kind of thing. Obviously it's not perfect, it's people's opinions, and you know, we would all kind of disagree, but Camilla Townsend's Fifth Son pops up a bunch of times, and it's actually a good way for all of us, I would say, all three of us, and maybe even high school students. It's very easy to navigate, and you can see these lists, and then the author's saying why this is why they think it's a good book. And that's one way through. If you pick up a book on the Aztecs and it's a new book, first of all, start with some, don't go back in time, and look to see who's cited in the back. I think, a high school kid can pick up a book and go into to bibliography and is perfectly capable of seeing, is Townsend's Fifth Son cited in here? Just a book written since that book came out. Is it in here? If there's no mention of Townsend at all, that is possibly a problem, right? And you're going to see that means someone, if they're not mentioning any of her works, because Fifth Son is only the most recent book that she's written about.
Right. I saw it. Yeah.
I would say also there's no mention of Schwala in there at all. That could be a problem. He's going to say if they don't mention me, but okay, aside from the two.
Don't mention me. But they should definitely mention the two, you and Camilla Townsend.
And also look at publication dates. If they don't have anything that's been published in the last 10 years, you probably don't want to read it.
Beautiful. Well, I think that's a great place to close out. Thank you guys so much. This has been really enjoyable.
It was fun.
And
Matt, I love ranting about the Aztecs. Anytime.
I'm always a good audience for that. As you can
tell.
Thank you to my guest and also to Colin McGrath for the beautiful background music. You can check out all of Colin's music, including his amazing album Window Seat, on Spotify. You can also take a look at my books, upcoming picture books, materials for teachers, and writings on authentic assessment and other topics in social studies like role plays and mock trials at davidsharon.com. Thanks for joining me today. Hope you come on back.